My name is Gwen Haugen, and my topic of discussion is, or the session, is 3 weeks in Calcutta. During Lent this spring, my sister and I made a trip to Calcutta, and this is how it happened. I knew a young girl who was a flight attendant, and she often did, she would go to places and escort a baby back for adoptive placement in America. And when she was in Calcutta at an institution to do this, she decided that she wanted to visit Mother Teresa's institutions, especially the Home for the Destitute Dying. This is the first institution that Mother Teresa established. It's for the completely abandoned, the completely hopelessly ill people. It's a place where they can die with a scrap of dignity, with somebody beside them at the time of death, even though they've been neglected the rest of their lives. Well, she told about her experience as a volunteer in this home for dying, and I worked for a newspaper, so I interviewed her, and I was so impressed with what she told me about the spirit of the patients at the hospital who were ready, who were at the point of death, but still were so patient in their suffering and so cheerful. And the spirit in the home for the dying was something that Lynn, this girl, was very impressed with. So I wrote an interview. I had an interview with her, and I wrote it for my newspaper. And a year later, she brought a young man to Wanamingo. He was a doctor from India. And he, too, had been a volunteer in Mother Teresa's Home for the Dying, besides being a doctor. And he had found the time to also work in this institution amongst the dying people there. So I had another interview. And I feel like I wrote the two best articles I ever wrote in my life because I was so impressed with what these young people were doing in Calcutta. So I wrote to my sister in Decorah, Iowa, and I said, let's save our, maybe we should save our pennies and do this. And she wrote back with exclamation points, let's go. And that's how come we went. I might tell you that Marie, my sister, is an alumnus of Holden. She was here with her husband, Pastor Gordon Smeshrud, in the early years, about 1962, she was here. So she was a good traveler to have along when we went to Calcutta. Well, on March 13th, when we were at the airport, most of our children were there to see us off, and Marty and Linda were the last ones to come. And as they hurried toward us, Marty said, I was at a meeting, and I told them I had to leave early because my mother was going to Calcutta. And they said, well, we've heard excuses before, but that's a new one. Anytime that you get an idea that's a little out of the ordinary, you start looking at your motives for going and to see if you're in God's will. And it seemed that for Marie and me, we were, because things just seemed to work out. She was in a college town where she could make the flight plans, and I was talking to this Dr. Das on the phone in Toledo, Ohio, to help get me contacts in Calcutta. So we just set our dates out of the blue and said, we are going to Calcutta. We found out that it was what people said. Once you get into that city, you're completely immersed in it. Other people have said the same things. It just takes a few hours. I tried to analyze why I felt that way about it, and one reason, of course, is that it really attacks your senses. You've heard about the smells of Calcutta, and when you come in there, the rotting vegetation, but then then there's the lovely spicy foods and the charcoal fires and the fragrance of flowers, but the industrial grime, and there's just this overpowering sense of smell that you have as you come there, and also the sounds and the feel of Calcutta. For us, it was the crowds, and we were there when the heat had already arrived. It was the feel of Mother Teresa's hands on my head. So I'll have to tell you what our three motives were as we looked at why we were going. The first thing, of course, was that we wanted to see Mother Teresa and see this home for the dying, where people suffered with such patience and such good spirit. And then we wanted to volunteer there too. So that was the first reason. The second reason was I wanted to see a third world country, even if India is a developed world country. And I also wanted to bring something with me so I could feel I was carrying something to the poorest of the poor in Calcutta. So I had a quilt along that the ladies in my church made, and I had a suitcase full of baby things for the International Mission of Hope. And somewhere in Calcutta, there's a little child wearing a t-shirt that says, "Somebody in Wanamingo loves you." For you people that don't know it, that is my hometown, Wanamingo. And I also brought $300 in money, a money order, that my friends and my family collected so that I could bring it with me and give some to the Sisters of Charity and some to the International Mission of Hope. Another reason I think that Calcutta made such an impression on us is that it's such a city of contrasts. Extremes. There's a man, Walter Kaufman, that has written a book called Life at the Limits, and it's about Calcutta, how there are such extremes. A few of those are like, for instance, you talk about that it's a city of starvation, as you well know. On one street, you will see somebody dying, lying on the street at the point of death. These are the people that Mother Teresa and her Sisters of Charity come to pick up. In the street next to them is probably the most abundant display of fruit and vegetables you've ever seen. Oranges and grapefruit and bananas and coconuts and gorgeous tomatoes and cucumbers. And you think, why can't you take some of that food from this block over to this block and feed this hungry person? And then, of course, you know that this man has been malnourished all his life and there is no way that this food would do him any good. The abundance in India is very obvious. It is one of the world's biggest producers of wheat and rice now. But is in so much of the world, of course, it isn't the lack of food. Their gardens produce at least twice a year. It's getting it where it belongs and getting these people to the point where they can appreciate what they have. Then, of course, there's a contrast of filth and cleanliness, because you see the streets with the gallons of urine flowing in the gutters, and you see the mud houses and the dung cakes. Of course, the dung cakes that they make they use them to pretty good use, but you see them drying with the handprint where they use them on the walls of the houses. But the filth is everywhere else too, because of course their antiquated sewage system can no way take care of what this city has. But then, as I said, the cleanliness, there's life on the streets, there's always some washing going on. The water comes rushing out of these fractured drain pipes, and the day starts, they're bathing themselves in the streets. And the women are down at the river flogging their clothes on the rocks. And the saris, I don't know if it's sari or sari, but the clothes they wear are fluttering from all the balconies. They wash them by hand. So there's a lot of clean people in India too, in spite of the filth. That's one of the other things. It's a city with a lot of foreign elements, governments and that sort of thing, all the different revolutionary types of governments and religions. We saw communist rallies 3, 4, 5 times. There was one in a big open space. There were marchers. and with their bullhorns and very long, long communist displays and writings on the wall. The governor of Bengal, of which Calcutta is the capital, is a communist, but the director of Lutheran World Service told us that communism has failed Calcutta also, and they think they just sort of live with it. The ideology of communism hasn't helped them any more than anything else. But it is a city with a lot of unrest and revolution, and still it's a city where I felt safe. Somebody told me that I would feel safe there, and they're such a gentle people. You could walk, maybe it's just because there are so many people, and I know there are things that happen in Calcutta, but there was no drunkenness that we could see, no drinking, and the women are so modest, and the men are so comradely, and it was, of course, we stayed at the International YWCA guest house, and there were security police there all the time, but I felt safe in this city of many elements. It's a city that Mormon, he has written a book called Calcutta, calls the richest city in Calcutta. So here's another contrast. And then we have this poverty. It's a city with foundries and a dockside, the river, the ships come in there, and the banks and the stock exchanges and all that. There's plenty of money in Calcutta. But then it's a city with the beggars. And I guess if there was anything that I couldn't resolve in my mind, it was how to handle the beggars. And I still don't know what you do about it. They told us don't give them anything because they'll just follow you. They have their own modus operandi. The children, you say, why don't you go home to your mama? No mama, no papa. They were at the airport with reaching into the buses. There was a little mother that we came to know outside of the Y. Some days she had one baby, some days she had three babies with her, but she always sat there. She'd follow us downtown if we went downtown. A beautiful girl, and very sweet, and my sister was completely taken with her. My sister is a dreamer. She thought that in these 3 weeks she was going to make this woman work profitably. She was going to show her how to draw a picture, and then she could sell her pictures, and she would be working honorably. But it was one of Marie's dreams that didn't work out. But those beggars, sometimes we'd give them the hard-cooked egg from our breakfast. Or some of the more charitable people would give them the food left over from your meal and that sort of thing. I gave away some of my granola bars. It's something you can't resolve in your mind. It's a city of great inefficiency. At the Y, they told us the electricity would go off 5 times a day, and it did. The light bulb in one of our rooms wasn't working, and so we asked for one, and he came in, and he looks up, and he says, electricity, mystery. And he left the light bulb there. But my sister and I found, and our friend found a ladder, and we got the light bulb in. We asked some of the nicer homes we were in, still didn't use automatic washers. I feel that probably nobody would know how to repair them if they went haywire. And also, they do wash their things by hand. It's a city of inefficiency, but it's a city of great patience. You stand in line for hours in the queues to get your money exchanged and all, but they said, when you're in Calcutta, go with the flow. Patience, patience. Well, I could, and last maybe contrast I could mention is that it's a shabby city. It seemed like even their new buildings were dingy looking, but it's a city of great enchantment. The mornings at the Y were something I'll never forget. You could hear the dogs barking and the birds singing outside and the tennis balls bouncing in the courtyard and the Hindu chants and the Indian music and the voices of people waking up and the flowers out there, the vines out along the... It's a very enchanting city. And Tim said that he had heard the same thing about it. Why do people leave Calcutta and want to go back? When one of the men I was talking to on the train said, when you go back to America, don't speak too badly of our country. And I felt that's easy not to do that because we met people that were so gentle and so wholehearted in their friendship and hospitality. There's a saying, an Indian proverb, some of you have probably heard it, that Delhi is rich, Bombay is proud, Madras is clean, Calcutta has a heart. And we found that, I would say that there isn't a city in the world that has as much charity. Of course, that's another thing entirely that you can go into, the charity end of it, but as Calcutta, because it isn't just Mother Teresa and the Sisters of Charity, there are so many people there and so many volunteers who come from all over the world to help there. Well, there's no way that I could tell you what all we did in 3 weeks, but I just thought I'd tell you about the first 72 hours because it's an example of God's providence over us, telling us that it was okay for us to be there, and how one thing led to another, and it seemed like this trip, my sister and I would look at each other and our devotions in the morning would speak to us, see what he's done for us today, and we'd wonder what the day held for us. We landed in Calcutta we landed in India at 2 in the morning in Bombay, and we had to change planes to get to Calcutta. But Bombay was our first exposure to India, and the exchange of our money, and most of the people speak English, but there were a lot of Bengali-speaking people, and we had to transfer our luggage and go through customs and all that, and get used to the restrooms. Any of you know anything about third world restrooms? My sister told me, but I didn't believe it. But I got used to it. But anyway, that, not at the Y, but in the public places, that's the way the third world, and the beggars, and the people sleeping on the floor. This was our first introduction to India. We flew into Calcutta about 9:30 to Dum Dum Airport. You know that's what it's called. That's no joke. That's really what it is. But my sister always sat by the window. Not that crazy about flying. And she said, look at the people. She could already see the people below us in the streets as we neared Calcutta. And there were the security police and the guards there, and the beggars, all as we got off the plane. We had hoped that we would be met by Dr. Nirmal Kunti. I introduced you to Lynn, the girl who inspired us to go there, and her friend, Dr. Das. But Dr. Das and Lynn had another friend whom they said would really help us once we got to Calcutta, and his name was Nirmal Kunti. And he probably was the hero of my whole trip because this young man was something. And we thought, well, maybe he'll be there. But if he wasn't there, we really didn't know what we were going to do if he wasn't there. But my sister had written a hurried note to Lutheran World Service to say, ask if that we could see some of their facilities. Well, Dr. Kunti wasn't there. But the Lutheran World Service was there at the airport. We saw these two men standing there with a placket that said Lutheran World Service. And they had a car, and they really made such a difference in our first 3 days. So we had our first ride careening down the left side of the street with the taxis honking and the little rickshaw bells ringing and the bullock cart swaying and the cows in the middle of the street. We were on our way to downtown Calcutta in the back seat of this car. And then as we neared downtown, we saw the first street dwellers, the people living in packing crates and along the river embankments, and we started to see the poverty along the streets. They brought us to the Y, and the Y was, in a sense, was a very fascinating place, kind of a little bit Holden-like. I mean, there were a lot of young people from all over the world that had had all kinds of experiences there. But Lutheran World Service said, "We'll be back for you in 2 hours." I can't throw away the agenda they gave us because it was so precious to me. This was the agenda they handed us for the first 3 days. And this made us so thrilled because, you know, we just planned this trip ourselves. We didn't really know what we were going to do. And here they had this for us. "We'll be back for you," they said, "in 2 hours." And they took us to their Entelli project, which is one of their schools. And the children were waiting for us there with tape music, and they sang "Baba Black Sheep," and the little girls danced in their saris, and they showed us their classrooms. Then we went upstairs to the self-employment project, and I'm wearing the batiks. Their batiking was so beautiful that we did most of our shopping in their self-employment project. They did a lot. We bought caftans, and my sister bought a big hanging for her husband, made there. The weaving is from there, and the cards are from their self-employment project there at the Entelli Lutheran World Service. And at every time we visited a Lutheran World Service project, somebody would come and talk to us about what they were trying to do. They always talked so fast. It seemed to me there was so much to do, they were frustrated that. And on the top of one of their brochures, it said, "Do not sit tight and curse the darkness, but instead light a candle, at least a candle." And it seemed to me Lutheran World Service was lighting 1,000 candles throughout Calcutta because they were trying so hard. After we'd visited there, they took us back to the Y and they said, "We'll be back for you tonight. There's a reception." It wasn't in our honor, but it was in honor of one of their officials who was leaving. And it was Marie and I and a couple of Norwegians who came in the same day that they were giving these tours to. And we went to this reception at the home of Dr. Aga Larsen, who is the director of Lutheran World Service, and he and his wife Sally were our host and hostess. It was a garden reception. It was just utterly beautiful. There were lights in the trees, carpets on the grass, and rattan furniture and an Indian buffet, and the ladies looked so lovely in their saris. Dr. Larson's wife, Sally, was herself a real volunteer. It was good to get into conversation with some of them. They had a child that they had adopted from either Mother Teresa's institution or the other one there. And another couple also had adopted children from there. She told me about how she used to teach and sell some of her things on the road and use some of the profits then to help with working amongst the poor. And when I heard about her schedule, I said, "How do you keep up that pace?" And she said, "If I hadn't done it, half of my world would have been dark." We found the people there very inspiring. This is one of my favorite souvenirs of my trip. Lutheran World Service has been in Calcutta for 10 years, so they have this anniversary booklet made. The lady that did the artwork for this book was at the reception that night, and it tells about what they have done throughout India. They have done much more than just in Calcutta. They've worked all throughout India. They came in 1974 after the partition, when East Pakistan became Bangladesh and the refugees streamed across the border. The border is only like 10 miles from Calcutta. And it isn't only the refugee problem, it's the typhoons and the hurricanes that have happened in the 10 years they've had all this, that they have tried to help the people out. We wished it hadn't been our first night in Calcutta. This was Friday night, and we had not been in bed since we left Wanamingo on Tuesday night. So I sort of dozed through some of the testimonial speeches. But I woke up when I saw a rat running along the ledge of the neighboring house, and I knew again we were in Calcutta. They took us back and said they'd be back in the morning for us, and they took us to another one of their projects, the Salt Lake Project, which is a housing project they're trying to build, 1,500 houses. They're taking these people who have been dispossessed so many times, refugees, and even they're packing crates, and that is home to them, of course. But they come. The government is working with Lutheran World Service, and they come with their bulldozers and flatten out their houses and say, you will move to these places. We want to prove to you there is a better place to live and a more honorable place to work. And so they also try to find jobs for them. They have the schools for their children, adult illiteracy classes, ways to get bank loans. They make tube wells, and they've got all kinds of rehabilitative work there amongst the people. They took us to two places that Saturday. They took us also to another place where they do rehabilitative work with handicapped, where some of the people were making artificial limbs. At 4 o'clock that Saturday, we decided that we better enter the world of Mother Teresa, which is kind of what our initial reason for coming was. The volunteers work from 9 to 12 in the morning or from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. They really don't want volunteers there at any other time. And the place is called Kalighat, or it was a former temple to the goddess Kali. As we took a taxi there that day, and as we came near the area, it was an area teeming with people and beggars and taxis and rickshaws and vendors and all kinds of stands. I could not believe that this is where the Home for the Dying was, but it was. We opened the door, and there was it was an open door, and there was the plaque, the Home for the Dying. One of the young men showed us the green aprons that we wore as volunteers, and then he showed us through the place. It wasn't much to tour. There was the men's ward and the women's ward and a multi-purpose room where they do the laundry. The women flog the clothes against the concrete vats, and it's the place where they do the cooking on this huge stove, and it's the place where they wash the dishes with moistened ashes and jute. That's how you wash the dishes. And we helped a little bit too. You squat Indian fashion and wash them right there on the floor. And that's how we did help with that too. But as we came in to the women's ward where we would be, there was nobody to tell us instructions. We knew that most of these people were very ill, and were more being made comfortable than anything else. So we did mostly rub backs, hold hands, console. We did feed them, we gave them water, we did change nappies, wash their bedding, and that sort of thing. But there are volunteers there every day, and there are volunteer doctors. And the exciting thing was Dr. Kunti was there that day. I had a package for him from my friends Lynn and Dr. Das, and that's where I got to meet him, was at the home where he volunteered. At 6 o'clock, we went to the Mother House on Lower Circular Road, where Mother Teresa lives, and the Sisters of Charity. Here at 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening, they have adoration or mass every day. And for 45 minutes, the sisters kneel, chant, and say prayers. And it's a room devoid of any furniture, but the windows are open to the street outside, and the noises of the street come in, but still there's serenity and peace in this room. The volunteers mostly stay at the back of the room. This is where you see Mother Teresa. If you want to, she probably comes in, but you don't even know she's there, maybe, because the room is dark. She probably just comes in and kneels just like anybody else, barefooted or with her sandals. She wears her white sari with the cross tied up here and a little stitching, patched sari usually. But when you can see her is afterwards out in the hallway, some of the volunteers. So that I was carrying my quilt with me that night, and that night I was able to give Mother Teresa the quilt. And I asked her to bless me, and she puts her hand on your head like that, and she told me that she hoped I would always work for the glory of God. Well, we that night, when it was over, about 9:30, we didn't see our young people around that knew their way, so another friend of ours and my sister and I decided to try the rickshaw. They said, well, you really should try the rickshaw when you're in Calcutta. But I thought there are only two places in the world where they still use manpower for the rickshaw, and Calcutta is one of them. And it seemed to me it was so dehumanizing. But then somebody reminded you, well, here again, at least they're working. They don't anywhere get enough money for it, but they're working as rickshaw drivers. So I could not believe it, but that night at 9:30, I just been with Mother Teresa, and I was riding in a rickshaw through the streets of Calcutta with the charcoal fires burning and the life of the streets. It was a night that, to remember. Sunday morning, Lutheran World Service was back to take us to an organization, a place where they have, they make limbs. It's a rehabilitation place, and they were honoring the work of Lutheran World Service. Here also, we got to find out how to get a hold of a girl. You know, 9 million people in Calcutta, and a friend of mine said, do you think you could find the little girl I sponsored? I found her. That's the way God helped us on that trip. And it was a man that day that told me how to find Ivana Lohar. He looked at the address and he said, sir, we can tell you how to get to see Ivana. I had a gift for her and a letter. All these things helped to make the trip, you know, more meaningful if you could do something like that. But there we saw young men working on artificial limbs that they themselves would be wearing. And also, they put on a skit for us that day that was just tremendous. This was done in Bengali, but I could follow the skit very easily because it was they were so expressive and they did such marvelous voice work. The one that was the head of the skit, he was a headmaster for the school, obviously. He was paralyzed from the waist down. They carried him onto the stage. But his voice work was so good, and he was talking to the students. It was a delightful experience to be there. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, we were back at the Y, and my sister and I decided we were going to try to call her husband, because I mentioned inefficiency. The mail is endless to get between Calcutta and wherever here from Minnesota or Iowa. So we got lost that afternoon in Calcutta trying to find the place to make the phone call. We walked for 2-3 hours. And when we finally got there, then we sat another 2 hours there trying to get this call through. And they said, we'll let you know when you can go into that booth when we get through. Well, finally they called her name, and the Indian people were standing and watching her there at the booth, you know, and I got a picture of her standing there. And then she went in the booth, and she went up to the window, and he said, we haven't been able to get out of Delhi. We gave up the phone call. We just trusted that our families would know that we arrived in Calcutta and that all was well. That was the end of Sunday. When we got back, I got sick. For 36 hours, I was sick. And my sister, she did real well. She got a doctor to come to the Y. And believe it or not, this Dr. Kunti came and saw me, and also some of the young people in the Y came up and gave us some good advice. And one young man showed me the what's inside of a coconut oil is supposed to be the best thing, the only pure food in Calcutta, I think. But you have to cut the top off and then put a straw in. And anyway, he came up and he had this coconut oil sliced off with the straw in there and a little sliver of lime on top. And there was just so many acts of kindness. We missed out on only one thing because of the fact that I was sick, and that was that we didn't get to see Lutheran World Service's pavement schools. They go to the places where the children are. I don't know if I mentioned that one of the contrasts in Calcutta is the illiteracy versus highly educated people. They say 64% of the adults are illiterate, and a lot of these children that are going to school are first generation educated. So I asked somebody, why are the so many children on the streets? And they said the government provides free education and free books, but too often the parents sell the books because they need the money, and also they probably need the children at home so mother can go and beg and father can push a rickshaw, you know. So they don't get educated unless the private organizations do it. But anyway, that Lutheran World Service does go to them and have schools on the pavement, but we missed that one. My sister came back on Tuesday with the news, the taxis are on strike. And that was quite a blow, because I had seen Calcutta, and I did not think there was the streets of Calcutta. I didn't think I would ever want to ride one of those trams or one of those buses where people were hanging out of them like bunches of grapes. And I thought, no way am I going to get on that thing and get lost. And also, I didn't think I'd ride the rickshaw that much. But the cabs were on strike for the next 10 days. And so if we were going to get anywhere, that's the way we did. One time we took the tram out to the Home for the Dying, and anyway, we were so jammed in, I thought, if they put one more person in here, I will suffocate. And then I was looking, you know, I'm short, so I looked up, and here were fresh flowers on the wall up there, you know, they do little things like that, I guess, to cheer you up. But anyway, I managed to get through that ride on the tram. But that was just one other thing where it did work out, although we were afraid that the taxi strike would put a crimp in our plans. On Tuesday, we had our first real audience with Mother Teresa, and that had been arranged. We saw her four times. The first time, it wasn't arranged. She accepted the quilt. The second time we saw her, I wanted to speak with her and get a receipt for the money to bring back to my friends, and I did. One time that we had an audience with her, my sister wanted to do this because we feel like we wasted our, that we did not take advantage of the fact that we were face to face with Mother Teresa, but we were so awed by this. But one very profitable time with it was to talk about co-workers in suffering. This is something that Mother Teresa has organized with some friends. If you feel that you cannot work for, say you're really old or really handicapped, there's no point in living. Mother Teresa has reached these kind of people. If you want to be linked to somebody in Calcutta who is working amongst the suffering, that is a co-worker with Mother Teresa. And in our last meeting with her, my sister was able to get the name of a Sister Luke with whom she would link somebody that needed the feeling of being needed here in the Midwest of America. Well, that was kind of the end of the 72 hours. And in the time remaining here, I'm going to just tell you a little more about the Sisters of Charity, because they own two saris and a bucket. They work amongst the poorest of the poor, just like Mother Teresa. I stood by one beside the bed of a person who was dying, and she said, I want you to pray for me this week because I'm getting close to my final vows, and I have to take my exams next Saturday, and then I have a week of solitude and silence when I can't speak to anyone before my final vows. The only time I will go out is to work here in the Home for the Dying. That was one of the girls. But she was jollying this patient along that was lying in the bed, the one I really got acquainted with. Her name was Mary. And Also, we came in one day when they were giving the place the once-a-month cleaning, and these sisters were down on their knees, scrubbing the floor with moistened ashes and jute, singing and chattering, and they move all the patients out of the beds and onto a different level, and then they scrub the place completely once a month. It was very clean in there. When you think of the gangrene and the TB and the cholera and all that, the kind of diseases these sisters are constantly exposed to, but the place seemed clean. And another time I watched them studying right there in the home for the dying. They were on a certain level where the beds were, and they were kind of resting on their knees, and one of the sisters was writing on a blackboard, and they were chattering and copying down their lessons. Everything seemed to be a pleasure for them. They never seemed to think of themselves in any way. They have totally dedicated their lives to this work. I don't have pictures with me, but I do have one picture that I really treasure. I found out I have two pictures with me out of all my pictures. But this one happened on Park Street in Calcutta in the middle of the day. And Marie and I were walking along, and it was very hot. It was beating down on the pavement, and here was a man lying right along the curb, obviously passed out. And Marie and I walked by, and other people were looking at him, and we said, what can we do? You know, and just like everybody else, the priest and the Levite and Marie and Gwen, we walked by. We didn't know, were we going to lift him out of there and put him in the shade? Well, we hadn't walked very far, and we said, we can't do this. We're just like the priest and the Levite. We got to go back. And as we turned around to go back, here was Mother Teresa's ambulance and the Sisters of Charity helping him, giving him water and assistance and offering him. And we just gave thanks, you know, that we could see this, the way she goes around in her ambulance and picks up people that are in this condition. One more thing about the home for the dying. Malcolm Muggeridge has written, he was completely taken with Mother Teresa when he interviewed her for a television program. And he wanted to do a film about her work. It took some doing, but finally she said, all right, let's do something beautiful for God. And so she agreed to do this. And when he came into the home for the dying with his camera crew, he looked around and he said, there's no way we can get any decent pictures in this room. The windows are all up there, kind of diffused light, and the patients are lying around down below. And so he said, we'll take some pictures inside and we'll take some out in the courtyard for insurance. And he writes, now you know Malcolm Muggeridge, he's kind of a pragmatist. To convince him, he said he couldn't, it was the miracle of the home for the dying. Those pictures were beautiful. The ones in the courtyard were diffused. He called it the miracle of the home for the, and he didn't know how it turned out, but the pictures were beautiful in that home. I told you I wanted to tell you a little more about Dr. Kunti before, and that'll be what I'll close with. He was, when, like I told you, I had hoped that he might meet us. Well, I found out how absolutely impossible that would have been when I found out about this man. For one thing, he lived in the home of his friend who was in America with his parents, which was way out in Calcutta. He had no car. He came in by public transportation. He had a regular job in hospitals, and he volunteered in Mother Teresa's institutions. She has institutions all over the world. She has four in Calcutta, at least four. And we met Nirmal in one of those at one time. So he's not a very strong person, I don't feel, but he is completely compassionate. And when he came to visit me when I was sick, he asked questions like, you know, how can I serve my God the best? And that sort of thing. He said, why does my country have so many problems? Very intense young man. But we asked him if we could spend our last evening in Calcutta with him. And so we met him at the Mother House after adoration. And we had supper together in a Chinese restaurant. And at the end of that meal, he took what was left of his food for beggars. He had it in a container that he was going to give. Well, we exchanged gifts, and he gave us an Easter card. This is the gift he gave us, Marie and me, each one like this. And he said, he says, it's just a cheap little thing. He said, the money goes to help the poor. I had the feeling that Dr. Conti and some of these people wouldn't spend any money unless the money was going for something that was, could be used. And then on his Easter card, he said, on the letter he wrote to me when I was sick, he said, most beautiful God, bless you always. That's the way he talks. And in the Easter card he wrote, dear Gwen Haugen, happy and blessed Easter to you and your family. Peace be with you always. Peace in the USA. Peace all over the world. God is with you and God bless you always. Love and prayers, Nirmal. So we said, will we ever see you again, Nirmal? Will you come to America like your friend that's research? Because I don't know if I'll ever get back to Calcutta. And he said, no, I don't think I'll come to America. Well, when will we see you again, Nirmal? And he goes like this. In heaven, we'll see Nirmal Kanti. But he was an example of the type of volunteers that worked there. It was very exciting to be a volunteer in Calcutta. I remember one time when we were hurrying towards the tram, I looked at the group that I was hurrying with, and I realized there were two girls from Japan, a boy from Scotland, a girl from England, a boy from Wales, and our friend from California that we met there, and two middle-aged, gray-haired ladies from mid-America who will never see 60 again. I thought I was in good company. And as I look back on the experience, I think, I suppose I could have taken, the trip didn't cost as much after we got there. As you know, the rupee isn't very strong there. And so we stayed for the equivalent of $5 a night in the Y, which wasn't, luxurious surroundings at all, accommodations, but it was all what we wanted. But I could have taken the money for my air flight and given it to somebody that needed it. Because certainly the volunteering that I did, I got more out of than I gave. And so you examine this. But I guess what I feel that I learned something from the trip was the difference, the space between the giver and the receiver in charity. Maybe I learned something about, what charity is, what real charity is. Maybe being there will help. But I look at it, I told you what Marty said when we left, and one of my daughters, when we came back, we had all our grandchildren, my grandchildren were there with this big, long welcome home banner that said, that they had done in computers, welcome home Gwen and Marie, and they were all holding it, Katrina and Matthew, and the, as we got off the plane. And one of my daughters said, she looked at me so strange, she said, oh, I was afraid you were going to say you were going back. And I thought, it made me stop and think, would I go back? And those are all the thought-provoking things that come. But I'm going to close with what they say in Calcutta. They put their hands together and say Namaste. Have any of you heard the word before? It's a greeting of love. Am I pronouncing it right, Carolyn? You've heard it.
Namaste.
Namaste. And this is where they do it. Namaste, friends. Thank you.